Welcome to Psy Radio with your host, Guru Nostra. The following information presented is the opinion of the speakers, but not necessarily the opinion of the TerraJet Network. All information provided is gained from open source and available on the internet. KVNMTO 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition. I am your host, Colin Knight, a.k.a. Guru Nostra. It's great to be here. Lots to get to tonight, so fill up your glasses, find your favorite seat, crank up the volume, and we'll be right back.
Of all the objectives we seek, first and foremost, is the establishment of lasting world peace. We know only too well that war comes not when the forces of freedom are strong. It is when they are weak that tyrants are tempted.
Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Ladies and gentlemen, the purveyor of political pontification.
The purveyor of political pontification. Good evening, everyone. Glad you could make it tonight. It is Thursday, September the 18th, 2014, 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Mountain, 10 p.m. East Coast, 4 a.m. London, England, and of course, 5 a.m. in Israel and Gaza. It is 15 degrees Celsius in the big city of Calgary, Alberta, Canada tonight. That's about 61 degrees Fahrenheit. Our imperial friends or so. Our ongoing report of issues from around the world, reviewing news and events which perpetuates the erosion of freedom from around the world. And we hope you will choose to participate, engage in the conversation, either by phone if you're listening live, 347-324-3287, or if you're picking up the show via archive, you can always drop an email, vocr2012@gmail.com. Remember, if you are calling in, we only request your first name and a geographical area. Other than that, you shall remain anonymous. Special personal thanks to all who have made contact and offered their support for what we do. Without the spy audience and operatives and readers and the private link information you supply, we would not be able to bring you our weekly overview of world events in such a qualified format as we do. Spy Radio broadcasts worldwide on the Blog Talk Radio service. Archive repeats on a number of repeater services, including the YouTube archives under VOCR Radio. We transmit throughout North America, Europe, and beyond on a live signal every Thursday evening. We remind you that our daily Spy Gazette provides news and views which mainstream media either refuse to or cannot report. Links and stories from around the world, and we invite you to check us out. Spy Gazette, that's SPIIGazette.blogspot.com. Couple of shout-outs tonight. First shout-out to Wildfire. Keep the faith, believe in yourself, and allow others to believe in you. To the BC Dreamcatcher, I sense a road trip coming on. It is fall, after all. A month or so from those slippery roads, you know. Time to buy those Christmas presents. Haven't had many Thanksgiving turkey yet, but it seems to be your modus operandi coming in from the hills to do your bit. Mike from British Columbia. Thanks for the update, Mike. We appreciate the inside information on all pipeline actions. We shall be focusing on the Canadian pipeline system in an upcoming Gazette special. And Julie from London, England, keep your information coming, Julie. Your links are very helpful to us. Sam from Oregon, thanks for your positive feedback on the show, Sam. And Marlene from Oakland, California, your updates on the California wildfires, Marlene, are very helpful, and we do appreciate it. And last but not least, of course, the Southeast Brickies, much better half. We need to do coffee soon, Beth. So much to discuss. When we return, phone lines will be open. We'll take a look at the Obama's unfolding plan for the defeat of ISIS. And we'll have a look at the world at large and, of course, the Scottish referendum to separate. Can you believe that?
We came back after 9/11. We dusted ourselves off, and we made sure that Osama bin Laden would never, ever again threaten the American people. We came back, Boston strong, blaming no one but resolve to be certain that this didn't happen again. Today, America may be grieving, still grieving from Jim Foley, but the American people are so much stronger, so much more resolved than any enemy can fully understand. As a nation, we're united. And when people harm Americans, we don't retreat. We don't forget. We take care of those who are grieving. And when that's finished, they should know we will follow them to the gates of hell until they are brought to justice. Because hell is where they will reside. Hell is where they will reside.
Now, as we go to air tonight, the votes are being counted in Scotland, either for the yes or the no vote to separate from the United Kingdom. We'll continue to update the story as best we can before the end of tonight's episode. However, the full votes will probably not be available until the wee hours of the morning in North America. Normally, at this point in the show, we would bring you the news stories and updates from around the world. So, in Scotland, as we air, the first results are, believe it or not, coming in on the referendum. Clackmanshire, aye lad, was the earliest to declare. They've declared no, winning by 19,036 votes compared to yes at 16,350. It was an 89% turnout. Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive turnout for such a major event. Now, as I say, counting will be carried out throughout the night. Individual results will be announced sporadically for each of Scotland's 32 local authorities. But the final results will be expected round about, in another couple of hours, 3 hours maybe. We'll already be off the air, unfortunately. But we'll keep you apprised of what's happening. Now, with all of that said, with such a calamity as the possibility of Scotland leaving the United Kingdom, we've got other countries such as Spain watching this referendum because they're wishing to break up their national identity. And, of course, we've got Quebec in Canada that are always looking for a reason to separate from Canada. It's going to be very painful around the world in the next few months, ladies and gentlemen. And my bet is that Scotland will say no. But that's just wishful thinking. But I tell you, frankly, nothing that we report could be more important than what we're about to talk about tonight. Let me just give you some background. Each morning, we receive dozens of links from news sources, friends, readers, listeners. We filter through them and systematically add them to the Daily Gazette, our underground stories, or a number of the other issues we release under the Spy Gazette banner. This goes on 7 days a week. These links come in, and each time we follow the link, we value the information released, and then we bring it up to the reader or the listener. We do this because we believe you deserve to know the truth. You deserve the information clean, devoid of mainstream media, in order to make valued choices in your day. Now, I must say that Spy Radio takes an incredible amount of time to prep for each week's show. And in such, it can almost consume you, and the responsibilities elsewhere are given less importance. Well, I have to say that after last week's primetime event with Barack Hussein Obama, we had a renewed sense of optimism, at least here at the station we did. We hoped he had finally seen the light with ISIS and was about to commit the full force of the free world onto them and vanquish them from this earth. As the week progressed, and the political spin doctors reviewed and dissected Obama's speech, it was quite obvious that Obama has no intention of wiping out the cancer in the Middle East, as we know as ISIS. In fact, his speech emboldened our enemies, if you will. They now know that Western forces will not commit to ground war. There shall be a no-boots-on-the-ground strategy. Now, late this afternoon, Congress passed the money bill to arm and train the 5,000 Syrian fighters who are supposed to fight ISIS after they have received 1 year's training. President Obama has said Congress is backing for his $500 million plan to aid moderate Syrian rebels, shows the world that U.S. is united against the Islamic State. He spoke moments after the U.S. Senate, of course, approved his plan, and a day after it was passed by the House of Representatives. He said the strong bipartisan support in Congress for this new training effort shows the world Americans are united in confronting the threat from ISIL. We call it ISIS. On Thursday, the U.S. continued to strike the ISIS targets in Iraq. And this jihadist group that's got everybody in a tizzy, IS, ISIS, ISIL, well, they do control large areas of Syria and northern Iraq. And even though the U.S. have undertaken over 174 airstrikes against it since mid-August, it continues to grow like a cancer. So now we're expecting to see some airstrikes in Syria, although Mr. Obama has pledged to not authorize any ground operations. He said we can join with allies and partners to destroy ISIL without American troops fighting on another ground of war. That was a White House statement today. Now, these Syrian freedom fighters are supposedly being sought out as friendlies by such organizations as the CIA. But when they are sought out and transferred for training to Saudi Arabia or Egypt or wherever they're going, it's going to be a year before they actually clash with ISIS, if their training is to mean anything. And out of 5,000, it'll be interesting to see what the dropout rate is. But in the meantime, what do we do? We just drop bombs on them in the meantime? We destroy everything that we built over the last 12 years of our building projects? Obama is the laughingstock to our enemies. He's shown himself to be weak, and more importantly, he has shown the U.S. foreign policy as hollow and without a spine. John Kerry is running around the Middle East and backing congressional meetings, claiming he has a Muslim coalition, yet not one Muslim country will commit forces. No boots on the ground destruction of ISIS. In fact, Iraq has denounced the idea and firmly opposes forces from other countries on Iraqi soil. But Obama is adamant he will not allow American boots on the ground, and he's making sure by sending another 1,600 advisors to northern Iraq, as he also sends 3,000 military personnel to Africa for the Ebola crisis. The Middle East countries, those peaceful Islamicists, they will happily throw their money at the cause. Money that's been earned from Western society's purchase of oil, but no country assets, no physical force. Now, in a sense, I agree with Obama's doctrine of no ground force. But why are the neighboring countries not taking out their own trash? They are the ones that finance them, they are the ones that train them, and they are the ones that let loose this gang to create havoc. Now, to me, I agree with Obama in such a way that it's time those responsible for ISIS put their dogs back on a leash. So in that, I agree with Obama. But for much different reasons than I'm sure Barack Hussein Obama believes in it himself. But there comes a time in existence, ladies and gentlemen, the existence of a country, that that country stand up for their own convictions. And it seems to me that if peace is the spine of their religion, as we claim it to be the spine of ours, then why don't they grow one? Why don't they show it?
Mr. Speaker, I thought nothing this president could ever say or do would surprise me anymore. But this flushed and breathless rush to embrace terrorists launching rockets at Israeli children is an unprecedented act of cowardice and betrayal.
Susan Rice was prepped to say the so-called protests were rooted in an internet video so as not to show a broader failure of policy. Now, we've impeached a president for lying about sex with an intern. A president has resigned in the face of certain impeachment for covering up a burglary. Why wouldn't we impeach this president for not protecting and defending Americans in the bloodbath known as Benghazi?
Josh, you've had Attorney General Eric Holder came out and he said that the inflow of Westerners into the civil war in Syria is, quote, the most frightening thing, more frightening than anything I have seen as Attorney General. You had the foreign policy experts in the Wall Street Journal talk about how this is instability not seen since the 1970s. Basically an all-out war, what's looking like an all-out war in Israel and Palestinian territories. You see the situation with terrorist group taking over vast territory in Iraq and in Syria. You see Russian aggression in Ukraine. You see concerns about Chinese aggression in the South China Sea. It doesn't seem like a time to be touting tranquility on the international scene. I mean, do you think the president's foreign policy bears any responsibility for any of this, or there's anything that he can do about any of this?
347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
In the Middle East, yet another British journalist is being paraded on the internet as the next possible victim to ISIS beheadings. Intelligence services are watching it very, very carefully. And bombing runs for five various NATO forces are preparing a mass exodus of ISIS operatives. Reports from Australia that a terror cell has been busted who were planning kidnapping a stranger off the street and beheading them and wrapping them in the ISIS flag to remind everybody of who they are. Terror on the home front. A couple of weeks ago, there was a report about a murder in New Jersey, which was a similar atrocity. Although it was covered up pretty good by the media, and they said that it was not a racial problem, that it was just a fight between two people, but it wasn't. Remember the British soldier in London last year? The public beheading? This is terrorism at its worst, ladies and gentlemen. And I hope you take heart of what I say, of what I've said often. If they terrorize you more than you terrorize them, they will win. Now, earlier this year, the Obama administration released five Taliban commanders to Qatar in exchange for Bo Bergdahl. He was an alleged deserter who may have collaborated with the Taliban and who also could have the blood of American soldiers on his hands. While the same was obviously done for beheaded journalists James Foley and Steve Sotloff, the Obama administration took it a step further, according to the families of both men. The website showbats.com reported all of this information regarding the Bergdahls, you know. So why didn't we trade hostages for Foley and Sotloff? Why only for Bergdahl? And why five highly trained Taliban commanders? Now, CIA Director John Brennan had allegedly been pushing hard for the release of those five Taliban commanders since at least 2011. Why? What caused Brennan to champion their release? Could the fact that Brennan is Muslim have anything to do with his decision? Or was there more to the gameplay that the CIA had their fingers in the pie? Because most certainly five high Taliban commanders seems to be a great price to pay for a possible deserter. A major issue with Brennan Obama's holders' actions are the consistency to operate against the established laws and wave off legalities as mosquitoes on a summer's day. Another major issue is the degree to which the Bergdahl family is connected to Islam. Again, Shobat reported on Bergdahl's father extensively, while both Foley and Sotloff appeared to be sympathetic to Syrian rebels, and in the case of Sotloff, apparently sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood. But there is a strong indication that Bergdahls were more than just sympathetic to Islam. So on one hand, we have the release of five high-level Taliban commanders to a nation-state that already openly supports terrorism, Qatar, in exchange for one soldier who may have defected to the enemy. And on the other hand, the same administration who made that deal forbade the families of two captive journalists to privately raise ransom money to have those journalists released. Michael Foley, the brother of James, told Megyn Kelly on Fox News how his family was treated by the administration. Stories fly around the internet that in one case, parents of the slain reporter were threatened with legal action by the administration if they continued their attempt to gather funds for the release. Now, the Obama administration have blood on their hands. Benghazi, and now the Bergdahl action, as well as the IRS, as well as Obamacare, as well as, doesn't stop.
The situation in Iraq has improved. Violence has been reduced substantially from the horrific sectarian killing of 2006 and 2007. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has been dealt a serious blow by our troops and Iraq's security forces, and through our partnership with Sunni Arabs.
Last night, like millions of my fellow Americans, I listened intently to the President of the United States lay out his new strategy for Iraq. We all hoped and prayed the President would present us with a plan that would make things better. Instead, I fear that what the President has proposed is more likely to make things worse.
You give me this office, and in turn, my fears, doubts, insecurities, foibles, need for sleep, family life, vacations, leisure is gone. I mean, I am giving myself to you, and the American people should have no patience for whatever's going through your head because you've got a job to do.
Attorney General Eric Holder came out and he said that the inflow of Westerners into the civil war in Syria is, quote, the most frightening thing, more frightening than anything I have seen as Attorney General. You had the foreign policy experts in the Wall Street Journal talk about how this is instability not seen since the 1970s, partisan foreign policy experts. I think that you see a wide range of people looking at basically an all-out war, what's looking like an all-out war in Israel and the Palestinian territories. You see the situation with the terrorist group taking over vast territory in Iraq and in Syria. You see Russian aggression in Ukraine. You see concerns about Chinese aggression in the South China Sea. It doesn't seem like a time to be touting tranquility on the international scene. I mean, do you think the president's foreign policy bears any responsibility for any of this, or there's anything that he can do about it?
347-324-3287, 347-324-3287.
And every so often throughout the show, you might hear my messenger going off. That's just the updates on the Scottish referendum. We will bring you those in a little while. But yeah, I was sadly disappointed. Obama's big prime time announcement about his plans to defeat and destroy ISIS turned out to be mostly, as usual, hot air. Defiantly, somehow, some reason, Obama refuses to consider boots on the ground to defeat ISIS, yet Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel announces 1,600 troops as military advisors to be deployed to Iraq. There, they will increase support for the fighting ISIS, those fighting the ISIS. Now, apparently, according to him, they're not to fight, mind you. Instead, Hagel said, these advisors are supporting Iraq and Kurdish forces in supporting the government's plan to stand up Iraqi National Guard units, and they will support intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions. Well, I hope that their engagement rules are better than the United Nations. I hope that they have been given orders that if they are fired upon, they may return fire. I do not believe that these soldiers that are heading up north into Kurdish areas to be point guard, to fire, send in the missiles and the likes against ISIS, I doubt very much that they will be able to do this without at one time or another being under fire. So I hope the rules of engagement have been laid out for these boys and girls that are putting their lives in harm's way. But that's the risk you take when you only send in $1,600. It's like taking a gun to a knife fight. The United States do one thing and one thing very, very well. When they go into a country, they go into a country. And there is a substantial boots-on-the-ground force required. And I'm afraid the Iraqi army cannot be trusted. The Kurds most certainly can. The Kurds have shown their worth. However, they are only interested in their area. They have no interest in going down to protect Baghdad or over to the Syrian border. All they're concerned about is securing Kurdistan, or what should be Kurdistan. So we will see how that flies. It's going to be very interesting to see how all of this mix comes together. And a story, believe it or not, out not in the Middle East. Holy Toledo. India and China have signed 12 agreements in Delhi, one of which will see China investing $20 billion in India's infrastructure over 5 years. At a news conference with Chinese President, India's PM said peace on the border was an important part of the progress. Talks came as India accused China of fresh territorial incursions in Ladakh on the border. Now, China is one of India's top trading partners, but they vie for regional influence and dispute the border all of the time. Mr. Modi and Mr. Xi made separate statements at the end of their talks in Delhi on Thursday. Apparently, under this investment plan, China has pledged to help bring India's aging railway system up to date with high-speed links and upgraded railway stations. They've agreed to set up industrial parks in a couple of areas. And they've agreed to give more market access to India to products, including pharmaceuticals and farm products. Both sides are also focused on increasing cooperation in trade, space exploration, and civil nuclear energy. Uh-oh. Now, Mr. Modi called for an early settlement on the disputed common border between the two countries and said the true potential of the relationship would be realized when there was peace in the relations and in the borders. Well, isn't that nice? So China and India, two juggernauts in the world economies, have signed the pact and are going to work a little bit more closely together. more bang for the buck, I guess. And mark my words, if they are successful, they will become a very powerful influence on the world commercial scene. Now, over in Africa, the UN Security Council has called the Ebola outbreak a threat to international peace and security, and urged the world to provide health experts, field hospitals, and medical supplies. A resolution adopted unanimously by the UN's most powerful body, an emergency meeting, with an unprecedented 130 countries as co-sponsors, all reflecting the rise of global concern at the outbreak. It was only the second time that the Security Council had addressed a public emergency. The first was, of course, HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa. The UN Health Chief, Dr. Margaret Chan, said the deadly and dreaded Ebola virus basically got ahead of them, and it was time to urgently catch up. She said this is likely the greatest peacetime challenge that the United Nations and its agencies have ever faced. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the number of Ebola cases was doubling every 3 weeks, and he called for a 20-fold increase in aid, totaling almost $1 billion, to tackle the crisis over the next 6 months. Ban said the largest outbreak of Ebola in history demands the attention of the world and unprecedented action. And the UN is leading the global response to contain and eradicate Ebola, and Ban announced that he was establishing a UN emergency mission to tackle the growing challenge. And more money. It's going to cost you more money, folks. He thanked the U.S. President Barack Obama for sending 3,000 troops to provide expertise in logistics, training, engineering. He also credited about 20 other countries which have responded with contributions and urged all nations coming to the UN General Assembly ministerial meeting next week to follow suit. A crisis within a crisis. As we watch the Middle East begin to collapse, and we see the Ebola outbreak in Africa, makes you wonder what we're doing wrong, huh?
I recommended to the president, and the president has authorized me to go ahead and send about 130 new assessment team members up to northern Iraq in the Erbil area to take a closer look and give a more in-depth assessment of where we can continue to help the Iraqis with what they're doing and the threats that they are now dealing with.
This so-called Commission of Inquiry established by the UN Human Rights Council is a travesty. It has about as much credibility as a kangaroo court. And its chairman, well, he has such a documented record of anti-Israel bias, I think any fair-minded person would demand that he recuse himself.
For the first time in 9 years, there are no Americans fighting in Iraq.
4 years ago, I promised to end the war in Iraq. We did.
4 years ago, I promised to end the war in Iraq. I did. Now, 4 years ago, I promised to end the war in Iraq, and I did. I told you we'd end the war in Iraq. We did. I said we'd end the Iraq war. We did. I told you I'd end the war in Iraq, and we did. I ended the war in Iraq as I promised. In 2008, I promised we'd end the war in Iraq. We've ended it. I was able to keep my promise and end the war in Iraq. 2008, I promised we would end the war in Iraq, and we've ended it. The war in Iraq is over. The war in Iraq is over. I'm ending the war in Iraq. That's why I ended the war in Iraq. The first time in 9 years, there are no Americans fighting in Iraq.
Do you have any second thoughts about pulling all ground troops out of Iraq?
You know, what I just find interesting is the degree to which this issue keeps on coming up, as if this was my decision.
347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
So as we look around the world and we watch what the United States have done diplomatically, with through Clinton and now through John Kerry, we have to look at the accomplishments. And I don't know about you, but I can't list any positive accomplishments that have happened during the Clinton or Kerry watch as Secretary of State. I don't remember any. I can't see any. There's nothing that steps out and says, hey, we did this, because I don't know they did. Now, Obama will tell you that we're better off now than we were when he took office. He'll tell you that. He loves to tout the defense of the banking industry and the automobile industry. They did a real good job of that. But I can tell you this. My retirement savings, my retirement investments lost 32%. Nobody bailed me out. I have to suck that up, buttercup. I don't get any reimbursement from the government as GM or Chrysler did. I don't get any money from Wall Street for the bailout or any of the banks that their backsides were saved. I'll never see that money. That money's gone into the black hole of that great financial department. Now, it is true that the United States is still pumping in over $80 billion a month into the economy to keep it afloat, while he tells everybody everything is okay, life's getting better. It's only getting better while the $87 billion is being pumped in. Now, they have made attempts to reduce the amount going in, and I believe they are down to just the top 70s, but still $70 billion being pumped into the system to keep it afloat, to tell everybody else they're doing well. The United States of America currently are carrying a $17 trillion debt, and it is climbing daily by billions of dollars. And some economists have anticipated by 2020, under this formula, the United States will be paying more interest on the debt than they currently pay in total. In other words, the interest will begin to accumulate, and the money that the United States will earn will be less than what is owed in interest, not in principal. So how does a country get out of a mess such as that? Well, for a country, it's a little bit more difficult. But for a major city like Chicago, it's relatively easy. File Chapter 9 bankruptcy papers. Destroy your creditors. Watch them collapse like dominoes. You tell the unions that their big fat pensions and their retirement investments no longer are worth a hill of beans, and they're going to have to accept 50 cents on the dollar. And you slowly start to turn the lights back on. A city that has one-third of its lighting system turned off permanently. You may again be able to fix some roads or some water breaks or the electrical system or the train subway systems. But you can't do that unless bankruptcy is achieved. And thus, a number of major cities around the United States, a couple in California are definitely taking a look at it. Detroit's definitely looking. Cleveland is probably going to be next. They cannot sustain the debt they have incurred by providing the social programs they have provided. They cannot carry the freight for the welfare system that Obama has created. They can't pay the food stamp system that Obama has created. There are more people on welfare and food stamps and unemployment in the United States than any time in history. Yet if you watch mainstream media, and listen to the Obama spin doctors out of the White House, life's getting much better. Life's getting much better for someone, not for those 109, 115 million that are on unemployment, welfare, or food stamps. Life's not getting much better for them. And for some, it's a blessing because it means that they get some items that they wouldn't normally get unless they worked. And for some, they choose not to work. It's not that they can't, it's that they choose not to. Because they don't have to. Because the system now carries them, willingly. Your taxpayer dollars at work. Something you should be proud about, but after a while it gets a little heavy. And like I say, going back that $17 trillion debt now, you know, imagine what's going to happen here unless somebody gets a hold of the accounts and gets it back into shape. Now, there was a mainstream media story that flew across the airwaves and lasted a whole prime time one night, and then it disappeared. Just weeks after the world learned about the two teenage girls who left Europe to join Islamic State terrorist group, there are now reports that one of them may be dead. Yeah. The two girls, Samra Kiznikov and Sabina Selmivik, made headlines in April when they ran away from home to join an Islamic extremist group. Almost 5 months after they disappeared, the world learned that the two teenagers had joined the Islamic State. Now, authorities haven't confirmed whether Kiznikov and Selmivik have died, though they have received information that indicates one of the girls was likely killed in battle. After reports circulated on Austrian television late Sunday, a spokesman for the Interior Ministry confirmed the reports to local Salzburg News. And they said, "We also have this information, and I've checked it out, but cannot say with absolute certainty that it is true. But the parents have been informed that their daughter could be dead," according to the officials. Now, before the news that one of them had died, rumors abounded online that one or both of the girls had become impregnated by Chechen fighters in Syria. There was conflicting social media accounts about it, purporting to belong to two friends, but they've alternatively gone silent. Austrian officials have doubted the validity of social media accounts purporting to be the teenagers, noting that it was highly unlikely the men of Islamic State would allow them public access to the outside world. So last week, the Times of India spoke to 17-year-old Yazid girl held captive by the Islamic State. And we're not quite sure what that was all about. But she did tell them the horrors that she was subject to. They certainly weren't sure of it. But it did sound awfully terrible. This poor young girl, the stuff that she was put through is, you know, quite heartbreaking. Quite heartbreaking. And if it, in fact it is true, then hopefully it rings bells for other people that are thinking of joining. And another story coming out of the White House. This one's kind of funky. Apparently Obama's whining again. He's upset that it's not easy for Michelle to see him not being appreciated. Yeah. Apparently, Michelle gets a little upset because the poor old boy isn't receiving any appreciation. Aww. And, of course, the Benghazi operation, the Benghazi committee meetings, and the information coming out of there most certainly must be giving Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton ulcers.
These last few years, we've seen an unacceptable abuse of power, having a president whose priority is expanding his own power. Any guess on who said that, Mr. Speaker? It was Senator Barack Obama. Here's another one. No law can give Congress a backbone if it refuses to stand up as a co-equal branch. The Constitution made it. Senator Barack Obama. What do we do with a president who can basically change what Congress passed by attaching a letter saying, I don't agree with this part or that part? Senator Barack Obama. I taught the Constitution for 10 years. I believe in the Constitution. Senator Barack Obama. And my favorite, Mr. Speaker, one of the most important jobs of the Supreme Court is to guard against the encroachment of the executive branch on the power of the other branches. And I think the Chief Justice has been a little too willing and eager to give the president more power than I think the Congress or the Constitution originally intended. So my question, Mr. Speaker, is how in the world can you get before the Supreme Court if you don't have standing? What did the president mean by that when he looked to the Supreme Court to rein in executive overreach? If you don't have standing, how can you possibly get before the Supreme Court? So my question, Mr. Speaker, is what's changed? How does going from being a senator to a president rewrite the Constitution? What's different from when he was a senator? Mr. Speaker, we are not a country where the end justifies the means, no matter how good your motivations may be. We all swore an allegiance to the same document that the president swears allegiance to faithfully execute the law. So I will be listening intently during this debate for one of my colleagues to explain to me what that phrase means. What does it mean not to execute the law, but when the framers thought enough of that phrase to add the modifier faithfully? What does that mean? And if a president does not faithfully execute the law, Mr. Speaker, what are our remedies? Do we just sit and wait on another election? Do we use the power of the purse, the power of impeachment? Those are punishments. Those are not remedies. The remedy is to do exactly what Barack Obama said to do, to go to court, to go to the Supreme Court, and have the Supreme Court say once and for all, we don't pass suggestions in this body, Mr. Speaker. We don't pass ideas. We pass law, and we expect them to be faithfully executed.
Trey Gowdy, I got to tell you, is quite the interesting man. I'm looking forward to the rest of the Benghazi committee and the investigations that they have underway right now. It's going to be very, very interesting. Well, with 11 minutes to go in the show, story coming in from the capital of Edinburgh to the far-flung Shetland Islands, Scots have embraced a historic moment. And the rest of the United Kingdom are holding its breath after voters turned out in huge numbers for an independence referendum that could end Scotland's 307-year union with England. The results that have trickled in early Friday brought cheer to the anti-independence Better Together camp. It won in central Clackmanshire, the remote Orkney Islands, Shetland and Western Islands, which had been considered a yes stronghold. Those areas all have small populations, however, and results from the big cities of Edinburgh and Glasgow are not expected for several more hours. Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson was on the BBC, and she was confident the silent majority of Scots would deliver a no victory. But the yes campaign said it was too early to predict the outcome. After the polls closed late Thursday, a nationwide count began immediately of the 32 regional centres across Scotland, and many Scots stayed up overnight in homes and bars awaiting a result that could possibly change their lives, shake financial markets worldwide, and boost other independent movements from Flanders to Catalonia to Quebec. So we are at that verge, ladies and gentlemen, of whether Scotland is going to ride the independence train, whether they are going to become independent from the United Kingdom, and if they are going to be able to navigate their way out of 307 years of intertwined relations. Now, of course, England is hoping that the no vote passes because they do not want to have to realign their nuclear facilities. You see, their nuclear missiles are all up in Scotland. They're all set up in the high ground. And if Scotland becomes independent, England will be required to move them down back to England, unless they make some kind of a compromise, which I rather doubt. But more importantly, England has said that if Scotland does break away from the United Kingdom, then they will have to float their own financial services, their own money, so their own stock exchanges and the likes. And there is talk out there that possibly the markets are not going to enjoy this very much. So hold on to your hats, withdraw all of your retirement money as much as you can and hide it under your pillow, because once this financial market starts to rock and roll, it may be a very bumpy ride for the rest of the Western world for a while. Now, Scotland is banking on their oil rights off the North Sea, and they're banking that this will be able to support their financial requirements as an independent nation. But the numbers in the North Sea have been dwindling. It is becoming harder and harder and harder to find those deep wells and pump that oil back over to Scotland's refineries. So some analysts are predicting that the North Sea oil is already starting to bottom out, if you will. And that's unfortunate, because that is one of the few sources of major revenue that Scotland would require to maintain an independent nation. And if they tried an independent nation and failed, and then came back into the fold of the United Kingdom, I am sure the deal that they had from 307 years ago and the deal that would be offered them in today's markets would be somewhat different. I'm hoping that Bend makes a choice, not because I don't want to see the United Kingdom broken apart, but because I think it's best for Scotland to find a method of independent rule while still being attached to the United Kingdom. I think it's necessary for Scotland to take care of most of their own issues as Scotland an independent country. But I also think that they have to rationalize and realize that they are part of England, the United Kingdom, which is England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. That makes them strong. They make them a powerhouse. You remove Scotland, and it's like removing a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. And everything else has to be altered to compensate for that, which makes it very, very difficult. So I'm hoping that Scotland make the right choice and say no, if only for economic stability of the next few years. That is the only way this world is going to get out of this financial mess they have found themselves in. And going back to Obama, I have absolutely no idea any government, conservative, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, I don't know how any government will be able to service a $17 trillion debt. It's impossible to fathom that more than interest can be paid on that debt at any given time. If you can never pay down the principal, you will be paying the interest on that debt for the rest of the existence of the United States. It's an open contract. Now, the sad thing about it is much of that money that is being borrowed and given to the government to spend on a daily basis is being borrowed from internal services, such as pension and health. Much of that money is being taken out of entitlements, entitlements that will go bankrupt without the proper funds in place. But for now, it seems to be Obama's best chance to seek a source of money. There has been no attempt whatsoever to wrangle the debt during the Obama administration. Over $80 billion a month poured into the economy to float the magic bubble. And yet they say that we're doing so well. 109 million people out of work in the United States. Millions more on welfare. Millions on food stamps. Houses falling into decay. Highways dilapidated. Major cities with a third of their lighting turned off to save power. And unions continue to hammer at the door for more money, more perks, more retirement. And the beat goes on. Ladies and gentlemen, we're 3 minutes from the end of the night. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Spy Radio will be going into hiatus for a month or so. And Night Talk Radio is being activated and will be running beginning next week. So watch the listings for Night Talk Radio, things that go bump in the night. We'll enjoy doing that one for a little while. Spy Radio will be back. After it regathers its wits and contemplates the issues of the future. In the meantime, tune in for Night Talk Radio, things that go bump in the night, the paranormal, the unknown, those creepy, crawly things. And we got some great guests lined up, I got to tell you. Some of it is pretty darn exciting. You'll just have to stay tuned to find out who it is, I guess. But you'll want for nothing. It'll be a good show, and Night Talk is always a very, very good show. So, we're looking forward to that one coming back up on the air. And that should be here probably by next Thursday, Friday, or Saturday or so. I just have to finish talking to the producers, and we get to go, and we go. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madam and messieurs, it's been an absolute pleasure. We'll catch you on Night Talk Radio over the next couple of weeks. And don't worry, Spy Radio will return. Until then, adieu.
Got a minute? We all have busy lives, and sometimes we forget the small things in life that make many people happy. We work hard, and we earn a great deal of money, or we hope to, and we spend a great deal of money. And yet there are those in our world who have no money to spend. There are those in this world that are fighting for survival as we speak. Give a moment to think of those people. Do what you can as a good human being. Do what you can to help their world be a little brighter. Good night, and we'll catch you back here on the next edition of VOCR Radio. This has been a TerraCast Network production.